what ended up happening was you had all of the European know-how come over to the U.S. and start sports betting. And here we are 5 years into it, and everybody sells the same product. It's like, no wonder it costs $900 to get a new customer. It's like, you guys brought all your old tech over. You brought all your old engineers over. Like, you built the same product for U.S. sports, and it's not soccer, right? So that's what we saw 6 years ago. Like, if we could build something different, by the time those guys realize it, they're going to be years behind, which is what's happened.
This podcast is brought to you by Pragmatic Solutions, the leading iGaming PAM platform with a modular approach, including many benefits like a fast, secure, and scalable API-based platform integrated with all major third-party products and services. Make sure you head over to Pragmatic Solutions and join our smart thinking.
This podcast is brought to you by Pragmatic Play, a leading game developer providing player favorites to the most successful brands across the industry. With an award-winning multi-product portfolio of slots, live casino, bingo, virtual sports, and more, Pragmatic Play is powering up new possibilities of play through one single API. Visit pragmaticplay.com and discover your favorite every time.
And boom, goes the dynamite. We are back here at the Vested Interest podcast. All of us on stateside at the moment. How is life over in Miami, Benji, first and foremost?
Life in Miami is good. You know, of course, last week we were all in New York and got to see you guys there. And now good to be back by beachside, as we say.
Right. Lloyd, you're also decompressing at the moment down there in Miami.
Not decompressing so much. I'm here for work and for meetings and squeezing a podcast recording in between. But nothing wrong with Miami Beach in March. It's a good place to be.
That is for sure. Well, it's good to have the boys back here for the monthly recording here of the Vested Interest. And as the dust has somewhat settled on last week's event here with Next NYC, I wanted to start off by kind of asking a little bit on the trends and takeaways from the event that was. It was a hectic event. We had 1,000 delegates and a lot of events and activities that happened throughout the week. But Bendy, you know, if you think about last week and the conversations that you had, the panels that you saw, and just observations in general, what were your key takeaways from the event?
So first off, I wish I saw more panels because it seemed like there was some incredible content there. Same. And unfortunately, I was bogged down from one meeting to the next, which speaks a little bit to how great a conference it was. There was just some really strong people there and a lot of decision makers and good coverage as it pertains to both suppliers, operators, media people, and throughout the ecosystem. So kudos to you and your team, Pierre, on what I thought, I'm sure Lloyd would concur, was a fantastic conference. But putting that aside, you know, I think one of the themes for me is there's a lot of movement right now in the space. And it seemed like, you know, if you go back to this is, I guess, year three now of the Next conference, you go back to year one when the U.S. market wasn't just getting going, it had still been around. But it just seems there's a lot more movement right now. And we saw a little bit of this when we were speaking about GDE 6 months ago, where we felt like the M&A was heating up a little bit. And, you know, we saw some results of that in the last few months. And based on conversations that I was having at the conference last week, I think we should expect to see a lot more M&A in the 6 to 12 months ahead. Because I think that there's certainly a lot of conversations happening as it pertains to collaborations, as it pertains to potential acquisitions, and even some, and, you know, it isn't always like a newsworthy huge acquisition we're alluding to. In some cases, it might be smaller companies that are trying to find footing that are better off within the home of another entity. And I think we'll see some of those types of deals coming down the pipeline. But certainly there's a lot of conversation as it pertains to collaborations and different types of forms of M&A. And I would kind of cite that as one trend. And I think the other trend, based on some of the conversations I'm having, you know, we saw a lot more from this conference startups and companies that are getting involved in different forms of real money gaming. And you know, I think we look at that DraftKings deal with Jackpocket and them migrating away from sports betting and casino into other areas to become sort of an all-encompassing entertainment domain focused on different forms of real money gaming and in some instances free-to-play engagements as well. And I think that based on what I'm seeing at this conference and conversations that I was having, that is a trend that will continue forward over the next 12 months. No shortage of companies that are going into the sweep space, as an example. Of course, we see some challenges right now with some forms of fantasy, but there are other forms of fantasy emerging. And I think that the continuum and dynamic of real money gaming moving beyond sports betting and beyond gradual expansion as legislation permits on the iCasino side into select states is going to include some of these other dynamics. And those were some of the things and themes that I would say that I was seeing on based on my conversations in New York.
Yeah, I echo a lot of that. I'll kind of respond to each of Benji's maybe 3 points in reverse order. Continuing to see interest in other forms of real money gaming by operators, both those that are considered real money gaming today and maybe some that are not. The day after the Jackpocket deal was announced, I and Benji were both investors in Jackpot, probably their closest competitor. I received calls and emails from every single investment banker in the space representing every operator other than DraftKings, asking for introductions to Akshay at Jackpot, since there's certainly interest in stuff like that. And then, you know, on top of that, I would say it's not necessarily even just limited to real money gaming. You know, Fanatics is historically a merchandise company that now has launched a sports book and is going into live events as well. Benji and I were involved early in Betcha, a DFS company that was acquired by Vivid Seats, a ticketing company. So I think we will continue to see not only expansions into other forms and adjacent forms of real money gaming, but adjacent revenue streams as well. Moving further back to the M&A point, I started to see this at G2E in October and saw more of it now, which is exactly what Benji mentioned. More conviction and crystallization on the part of the corporate development teams at the market leaders as to what their buy versus build strategy is and what the trade-off between X number of dollars and Y number of months in marketing, in engineering development resources looks like. And I do think as long as the capital markets stay conducive to deal activity as they are now, we'll see more of that. And then finally, just about the conference, loved the new downtown location, thought it was significantly superior to the Midtown location. Coincidentally, I spoke at another conference last week at a third location by that same event company. And we were all talking about how the downtown 225 location where you guys did it this year was the best. So hopefully you're able to retain that. I thought it was great and thought you guys delivered on what I believe is the niche that you've carved out for yourself, which is highly targeted, high quality events with almost entirely senior decision makers, not just from the operators, FanDuel, MGM, Caesars. But you had the NFL there, you had the NBA there, and a really, really great group. And like Benji, I was so busy with so many great meetings with other attendees that I probably didn't get to attend as many panels as I would have liked. But I did see the agenda was jam-packed.
And I'm also, sorry, Pierre, I just want to comment on what Lloyd said. It's interesting. I was a little bit worried because I remember last year when you did Next and the two previous years when you were at the Convene further uptown, a much smaller venue, right? And you know, I think there were only 500, 600 people maximum in capacity. And there were certainly a lot more than that allowed in capacity this year. And I was a bit worried that in enlarging the size of the group, that the quality would get watered down in some capacity, but I really saw no evidence of that. You know, I just think it was, to Lloyd's point, a whole lot of decision makers there. And of course, there was more room now for some startups to come. And that's a good thing because it's investment focused and you had everyone from the VC community, to some of the banks, to some of the leagues representing there. And for some of the great startups in our space to be able to come and interact with all of that, I think is a big win for them. But yeah, just I thought it was really well done all the way around for sure.
Yeah, brilliant. Sorry, I lost you guys there for a minute. I just continue. Well, thank you as well, Benjamin. I think the learnings from last year is that we had to decline so many great individuals who we just didn't have space for, simply. So I was never worried that we were going to water down. I think that 1,000 person kind of mark is a good good number for a conference like this. So it worked out well. But, you know, the question has to be answered here now. You know, after 1 year of vested interest, you know, my friends here, Benny and Lloyd, you've become quite some influences in the industry. Were you able to move around the venue without having to sign autographs every 10 meter, Lloyd?
You joke, but several people came up to me as if we knew each other, and I soon realized it's because they are listeners of this podcast and recognized me from it. So only because of you, perhaps, did anything close to anyone asking like an autograph even happen.
I love it. Bendy, I have a question for you as well. So the conference started, I don't know if you saw the first initial keynote panel that was moderated by Contessa Brewer, but Julian Behagar, he's one of the general partners of YOLO Investments, a $650 million gaming-focused fund. He started that panel by saying, gambling is dead. perhaps a little bit to kind of grab headlines and so on. I don't know if you had any chance to see that, but is that a sentiment that you could feel as well, in any way?
That gambling is dead. No, I wasn't at the keynote, not because I didn't want to be there, but because, as alluded to earlier, I was just running around in a whole bunch of meetings and not signing autographs, but running around to various meetings. I'd heard when I was at one of the networking events at night, someone said to me that that's what Julian had said, and I didn't get a chance to corner Julian and question him on it. I'm sure he had an opportunity when on the panel itself to elaborate on what he meant. But no, I don't think I would concur that that gambling is dead in any way. Gambling and iCasino and sports betting, certainly in the U.S. market, but beyond globally, is evolving. And we have more and more in fact, we have markets opening up, such as Brazil, which is going to enhance the overall TAM. And, you know, I think we're seeing more regulation, right? So there might be some challenges in terms of how you operate your businesses, be it in the U.K., European Union, U.S. or other, based on different forms of regulation that evolve and different forms of accountability that perhaps weren't in place for operators previously that are in place now as it pertains to KYC and as it pertains to affordability clauses. So it might become a little bit more difficult in some instances to operate your business on a profitable moat, depending on what jurisdiction you're in. But certainly wouldn't agree that gambling is dead. It was around long before I was around. It'll be around long before after I'm gone. It's kind of built into human nature.
Yeah, I spoke to Julian briefly, and he made this face like, oh my God, everyone's been coming up to me asking if I said gambling is dead. And I think he meant to say something more like gambling 2.0 is dead and we're moving to 3.0. Gambling is one of the oldest behaviors that humans have enjoyed. I believe they found a pair of dice in the ancient pyramids at Giza. Sports betting revenues in the U.S. are growing 50% year over year, and some of the most populous countries in the world are opening up to regulated gambling for the first time. So I don't think Julian actually believes gambling is dead. I think, to Benji's point, he really was probably more referring to the fact that the people who control the purchasing power of tomorrow are a very different type of consumer than legacy gambling technology was designed for. And whether it's accepting crypto or being on Telegram or having a more visual search functionality, market leaders and incumbents are going to have to innovate and modernize if they want to keep up with the times.
Right. And a question I want to ask you guys as well, you know, I very much got the feeling as well, the sentiment here in the beginning, we talked about that M&A is heating up particularly. It feels to me that the M&A side is definitely overshadowing investments and funding into the startup landscape. We saw a lot of M&A taking place here in the last couple of weeks. But on the other hand, at the conference, there were a lot of institutional and professional investors that came from outside of the industry that were interested to understand our industry better, actually much more than previous years, actually. I don't know if you guys share that sentiment that M&A is overshadowing kind of the funding landscape, but we also kind of segment into the betting startup reports by Jesse Learmonth here. in a little bit. And that report made it clear that most of the startups in the industry today is positive EBITDA, and most of the startups are looking for funding, but at the same time they are saying that it's very, very difficult. So is it true that M&A is kind of like becoming more of the only option now for startups, or are we going to see continuing funding of the startup landscape in the US?
I'll just start by saying M&A transactions pretty much always get announced. There have just been a ton of fundraising rounds in our space that founders have either decided not to announce or have delayed the announcement of. The last 7 or 8 checks that we've written, honestly, still have not been announced publicly. We just wrote the largest check we've ever written as a fund, and that deal has not been announced. So I think most of what you might be observing is probably related to decisions around timing of publicity. There is plenty of fundraising taking place. It might be concentrated among fewer companies and what are perceived to be the best quality and best performing companies. But I would not at all say that there are even close to as many M&A transactions taking place as seed, Series A, Series B funding rounds.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. There's no shortage of action on all fronts, right? So, you know, when I look at both my portfolio companies as well as just the companies in general that are seeking funding, there's a lot of activity, to Lloyd's point, a lot of deals that don't get announced. And look, in Q1, there were a lot of deals that were announced, much more so in Q1 from this past year or Q1 2024 than any of the quarters in 2023. So, you know, the rebound as it pertains to activity in the space, M&A, funding, I would concur with Lloyd that it's along on both sides, not just one versus the other.
Just to mention on that point, I did see, I forgot who put out a Q1 report of, you know, as stated, Q1 funding rounds. And then I think there was a subsequent one where Benji Cherniak was quoted as saying some of those rounds might not have happened in Q1 of 24. I actually believe, if I'm recalling that report correctly, none, not a single one of those deals took place in Q1 24. I think one of the ones that was announced was actually a Q3 2022 deal that for some reason had, you know, almost a 24-month delay. So I actually still haven't seen any Q1 deals actually announced yet, or even maybe Q4. There's a bit of a lag there. Some founders don't want unwanted attention from regulators. Others don't want to give their suppliers negotiating leverage to jack up prices on B2B services. There's any number of reasons why founders in the current market are being more selective and deliberate with the timing of their fundraising announcements.
Okay, so to the next topic, to the second topic of the recording today. So we talked a little bit about the investor and kind of startup landscape and sentiment right now. And a really interesting report that was created by Jesse Learmouth here the other week in the betting startup report, it showed that there was 69 startups that participated in this report to kind of take temperature on the North American kind of startup and investment landscape at the moment. And a lot of really interesting data and points came out of that report, I think. And just, Benji, jumping over to you first and foremost, was there anything that stood out in this report to you? What did you learn from that? It was really, really, really a great report that Jesse put together.
Yeah, you know, look, it was a great report. I think it's long overdue to kind of take the temperature of the various startups in our space. I think it's a great initiative from yourself and, of course, from Jesse. One of the things that stood out to me is that, I don't want to be quoted, but I think I read that like 70% of the companies that participated in the survey have less than $500,000 of annual revenue, and only one of the companies surveyed has EBITDA of above $500,000. Now, I would kind of, the silver lining within that is that most of these companies expect to be positive EBITDA in 2024. I'm guessing that many of them aren't today, versus a much lower number than that, less than half that amount, being positive EBITDA in 2023. But it's still striking to me that with so many startups in our space, the majority of them are still kind of in that early, early phase where they're still working to get to that 7-figure mark in revenue, let alone EBITDA. And that there's only one company that's over, you know, 500,000 in EBITDA. That number surprised me, I must admit. So
of everything that I saw, that was kind of the biggest standout to me in terms of some of the challenges some of these companies are facing and getting off the ground.
Yeah, I was piqued by those figures as well, especially because of two other reasons. One is that a lot of founders, I think, understandably expressed a lot of frustration over their perceptions of the fundraising environment. And I'll mention, you know, sometimes you talk to someone at a big VC firm and there's someone who came from consulting and they had nothing to do with raising the money for that particular fund. I raise myself every single dollar that our fund invests. So when a founder is talking to me, I'm talking to a founder. I'm right there with them. I know how hard fundraising it is. I know how hard it is when someone who seems interested suddenly disappears and stops answering your calls and you don't know why. I could not empathize more. With all that said, the companies, as Benji just described, 70% of which are under 500K in top line revenue last year, and only a single one of which is over 500K in EBITDA, which means that as a group, they produced negative EBITDA for the year 2023. Those companies have also raised over $250 million collectively. And so, right, without trying to single out any particular company or person, it should be no surprise, and we should expect in a healthy functioning economy that a cohort of companies that raised $250 million and years later is still producing negative EBITDA would, in the aggregate, be struggling to raise additional financing. That seems healthy and orderly and quite reasonable to me, not at all to minimize, you know, the personal roller coaster of emotions that any individual founder could be on with their journey. So that was what really stuck out to me. And then also, frankly, usually I find surveys are just complete nonsense because you can't trust the people who are responding, and the people who are responding kind of don't put a lot of effort in. Really amazing job by Jesse and everyone who's involved getting actual insights and real and valuable data. We should mention that in general, the biggest, most successful, best performing companies don't have time to do things like fill out surveys on the status of startups. And I think that is reflected in the fact that only one company in the survey was doing over $500,000 in EBITDA. There are certainly many more companies doing over 500K in annual EBITDA in the space. And most likely for any number of reasons, you know, they did not participate. So we probably are looking at a slightly below average group in the whole, rather than one that does properly represent the entirety of the distribution. And I thought those were some of my takeaways. I hope Jesse and everyone else continues to do this in years to come. It was very insightful.
I thought one thing that I took note of in the survey is that there was a question there: how have you funded the company? And 75% answered by external funding, and 25% answered by bootstrapping. And I just took note that shouldn't all startups be bootstrapped, like whether they are funded externally or not?
Well, maybe the question has to be redefined to include all three, right? Were you bootstrapped completely? Were you externally funded completely, or some combination thereof? Were you bootstrapped from a while but took a few bucks from here and there? And I think some of the companies within that 75% and within that 25% were probably some combination of the two.
Right, right. And you know, a question must be asked here as well. I mean, you guys obviously have deep insight into the portfolio companies that are under your control, so to say. Do you echo this sentiment in general? Well, like if you compare this to your own portfolio, so was there a slight difference there? You mentioned, Lloyd, for example, that this cohort are perhaps more towards the like underperforming companies, those that have a little bit more time to fill out the survey, perhaps.
Well, I'll answer that one and say that the reason it surprised me is because I don't view it as that reflective of the companies within my portfolio. Sure, there's companies that are struggling within my portfolio, but there's a number of companies that are excelling and doing well. And to Lloyd's point, the ones that are doing well are generally pretty busy doing a whole bunch of things right. And then just, you know, they're in it and just doing so many things. And for whatever reasons, they just either weren't asked to or chose not to participate in the survey. But I don't view those numbers and those statistics as representative of my portfolio companies. Some of the things that I do view as representative of my portfolio companies, some of the challenges I see as I kind of see some of the commentary from the various startups where they talk about you know, B2B integration challenges. We saw a number of, you know, the companies talking about that didn't surprise me at all. Or, you know, some difficulty in raising capital or finding product market fit. You know, those are themes that didn't surprise me.
Yeah, same here. It perfectly mapped onto the fundraising experience of companies in our portfolio that have not yet quite reached product market fit and have not quite hit their inflection point. But the hottest companies in our portfolio, I mean, some of them are turning away money and are, you know, not even taking calls with investors who are pounding on their door to get in. Look at Joey at Better. They just announced another raise at a $375 million valuation. And if I don't know for a fact this one, but I know the last round, I think Joey got together in like 48 hours or something like that. So there is, I don't want to say no shortage, but within the realm of high performing companies, there is definitely no shortage of investor interest and fundraising activity.
Right. And I believe the question was asked in the report as well, how many of the companies are planning to raise on additional capital in 2024? And something like 80% of the surveyed companies were at least thinking about raising more capital in the near term. At the same time, as you guys point out, of course, that very few of the organizations were profitable. Only 3 out of 69 companies surveyed were profitable in this in 2023, and so it seems that it's going to be a quite difficult year for a lot of the startups here moving forward in this particular cohort.
Yeah, I would, if it is a silver lining, I do think sometimes people view, especially venture capital, as this, you know, magic wand, panacea, fixes everything the second you get a term sheet. External capital, and especially venture capital, tends to be an accelerant and an amplifier. But if your business is failing, it's just going to accelerate and amplify the failure, most likely. And so I do think the silver lining for founders who are saying, hey, it's really hard to raise venture capital right now, my business is not in a position to do so. Well, the good news, if there is any, that you should already be fixing the business first, whatever that means, I think, before looking for significant outside capital injections. Venture capital is about, you know, growth and putting fuel on the fire. Very rarely does a VC firm come in and fix something that was, you know, completely broken.
And I thought the report itself was also really interesting from the perspective of, towards the latter part of the report, there was a section on the investors and kind of some of their thoughts and trends and findings. I think, Lloyd, you even participated in that along some of the other investors. And, you know, it was interesting just to see from my perspective what those investors view as upcoming trends and dynamics within the space, things like, you know, gamification and market regulation. I think one of the firms was talking about the iCasino emerging and you know, just some of the different areas in terms of the minimum bar of what they would look at for investment. I thought that whole area of the report was really interesting for me.
Right. And if I may kind of close this segment on a bit of a selfish note as well, there was obviously the questions here in relation to the conference landscape. And I was very happy to see that our conference was voted the best conference in North America for the startup landscape. So that was my personal highlight of that survey, I must say. So moving forward here, guys. Another topic that I'm really interested in, you know, every time we do these recordings, we talk about different concepts of investing, which I think personally is really interesting to understand kind of the other side of the aisle. And today we will talk a little bit more about how do you measure success of your investments in your portfolios. And so, Lloyd, perhaps starting on your side, is it all about looking at valuation to measure success of the portfolio companies? And how do you measure the valuations from year to year? Because obviously you are holding on to companies for an extended period of times before you hopefully make an exit someday. But how do you view this concept of measuring success of your investments and so on?
Yeah, I mean, over the longer term, certainly, you know, valuation or financial performance is really all that matters. We exist solely to deliver outsized returns to our limited partners. That is our job. And so all the measurements that matter are the ones that gauge our success or lack thereof in doing so. The two most popular metrics used to gauge the success of an entire portfolio or an individual investment are called MOIC, markup on invested capital, and IRR, internal rate of return. The MOIC, M-O-I-C, markup on invested capital in a specific deal, simply says, for every dollar that I invested, how many dollars do I have today? If I invested in your company $1 and today I have $5.50, I have a 5.5x MOIC, 5.5x markup on invested capital. IRR takes time into consideration. IRR is effectively the compound annual growth rate of the value of my investment smoothed over its life. If the value of my investment doubles in 1 year, that is a 100% IRR because the value increased 100% in 1 year. If my investment doubles in year one and again in year two, still I have a 100% IRR because annually on a compound basis, that is the rate at which my investments are growing. Those are the two primary metrics that we use at an aggregate basis. VCs also like to look at loss ratio, the percentage of the checks that they write that get written down all the way to zero, as well as graduation rate, which is a bit more of an interim metric of the checks that we write, how many of those companies go on to raise a subsequent institutional-led financing round. And so really those are the key metrics that we look at and care about over time. To your point, valuations in the interim can be a bit nebulous, especially between funding rounds. And so, you know, it's a bit of an art and science looking at comparable companies. We like to look at a combination of revenue growth and profitability metrics and use those to interpolate some growth rate, not just to tell our investors what it's worth, but to decide if we want to put more money into the company. And that's an equally important reason to gauge and measure the success. But IRR and MOIC really are the two metrics that venture capital funds use to look deal by deal, as well as at the aggregate portfolio level.
Look, on my end, I'm not a venture capitalist, right? So I invest my own capital into deals and, you know, get involved with companies that I want to get involved with. And certainly as it pertains to measurement of success, those are the terms that Lloyd and the phrases that Lloyd is using make perfect sense. You know, I go back to my Don Best days when I was operational, and we sometimes took a bit of a different approach to kind of get through the granularity of day to day and in an effort to achieve our various successes. And, you know, we kind of viewed it and we called it internally as the 100K effect. And we kind of just viewed every time we would do a deal to bring in $100,000, that 100K is a building block in our business. So, you know, every time I would do a deal, my business partner would be like, hey, Benji, did we close that deal? I go, yeah, we closed it. How much is it for? Is it 100K? Is it a building block? I'd be like, yeah, it's 10K a month. It's 120K. Oh, good. That's a building block, right? So we just kind of viewed each 100K that we were able to achieve in annual new revenue on new deals as one more building block towards building our house. And the 100Ks add up. You get 10 of them, you get to a million. You get 10 of the millions, you get to 10 million. And none of that is necessarily reflective in the granularity of the terms that Lloyd used in terms of MOIC and IRR. But it might be a simple way for some of the entrepreneurs out there to kind of measure how they're moving along on their journey and breaking it down. And if you do a deal that's only 40K, you're almost halfway towards a building block. That's kind of one form of measurement that I would use and that I still use today when I'm looking at my companies and their success and moving the right way down the path. And another one is kind of, you know, I often use the analogy that when we're starting our companies, we're kind of pushing a ball up a hill and you keep pushing and you keep pushing, you keep pushing. And it's hard to push because there's so many forces that can work against you. And you eventually get to a point where that ball starts going down the hill, right? And the deals start flowing in and the revenue starts kicking in and you start getting better at what you do and you've had more at bats and, you know, it's easier to hire good people and easier to raise capital because you've got more revenue. And, you know, you don't just get there automatically, but you got to look at certain variations along the way, like how many clients are live with the product and generating revenue. And as you get more and more of those, you're pushing closer to the top of that hill. And, you know, how many sales cycles do we have in progress and at what stage? And how many of our sales cycles in the last 3 months have moved from an earlier stage to the next stage in their progression? And all of that is, again, pushing the ball up the hill. And, you know, what progress have we made with integrations? And what progress have we made in terms of creating our IT framework to enable more seamless integration experience down the line so that when we actually sign deals, we can get clients integrated. And these are all components of pushing a ball up a hill that as you see more and more success as you get over the top and start moving the ball down the hill. And these are all things that indirectly, I think I use in, as ways of measuring successes of companies outside of the actual financials.
Yeah, I'm reminded one of our portfolio companies just brought in a new CTO to really bring the platform up to caliber, especially we're expecting a tremendous influx of users this year. And he has this incredible way of tracking days or hours worth of technical debt that the company has either accrued or paid down. And they have a big screen in the office with a dashboard that shows how many hours are going to be spent paying down technical debt today and how many are remaining. And, you know, we love seeing that type of measurement. More broadly, we ask every founder at every stage, what is your North Star metric right now? What is the one thing that you use for your definition of success that you are optimizing toward, that you are trying to maximize or minimize if it's CAC or something like that? And then we track that over our subsequent conversations with the company. And then should we invest in our monthly or quarterly updates? And many, if not all of the things Benji mentioned could be for any given business a great North Star metric. If you're building a company and have raised money or are planning to raise money and you're listening to this saying, I don't even know what North Star metric we might be targeting right now, figure it out as soon as possible, preferably before your next, conversation with an investor. You have to be measuring, you have to measure what matters if you have any hopes of iterating with intelligence.
Right, really important to find that North Star metric and then permeate that down to the organization as well. So it's easy for your employees and for your staff to understand what we are working towards and what we are focusing and what we are prioritizing on for sure. I have a question also back to you, Lloyd, in terms of measuring the success of your investments. I would assume that, the metrics that you point out seems pretty black and white. Like you look at these numbers and you have a multiple and how the organizations are performing. But isn't there also an element of these measurements being quite subjective? Like how do you put the valuation on an organization year by year that is not publicly traded, right? Like how do you figure that out in your portfolio companies in order to understand if your AUM is moving up or down?
Yeah, I think I prefaced that by saying those metrics are most important over the longer term, because either the companies do exit for some amount of money or they don't, and there's no longer any ambiguity by the end of the fund's life. Nonetheless, under GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles that most firms in the U.S. Would use, traditionally, you increase the value of one of your investments if they go and raise new financing from new investors at a new price per share, whether that's higher or lower. In theory, that is at least when that funding round happens, the most current price in the market. So that's the easiest way to gauge. Again, it's still not only subjective, but very illiquid and thus not a guarantee that it represents the actual amount of capital that will be distributed at the end. And then, for more mature companies, and especially for companies that maybe go several months or years without a priced financing round, maybe they've done several safes or convertible notes, but they've increased their valuation significantly. Most firms have a valuation methodology, not too different from the way they underwrite deals. If you are a Gen Z focused social media platform that has sports betting functionality, well, there's 14 other of those, and we can look at their revenue multiples and enterprise value multiples and compare that to your current metrics and average a bunch of those together and at least get, an educated guess as to what the new valuation should be. So a bit of an art and a science, perhaps, but there are plenty of ways to at least get directionally accurate indications as to how the value of your investment in a company is performing. And of course, you also have to factor in dilution and other terms that other investors receive that will ultimately impact the amount of capital you receive in the case of a successful outcome.
Right. And is it important for a company to be EBITDA positive if the if every round they conduct is a up round, so aka the Spotify model, let's say Spotify hasn't really been profitable for the last 20 or so years, but the company obviously has a high valuation on the public markets. Is it important, say, that your strategy is growth and you're prioritizing to grow top line as much as you can in order to consistently raise at a higher valuation? Is that a viable one-size-fits-all answer?
You know, over the short term, the market is a voting machine. Over the long term, the market is a weighing machine. At the end of the day, at some point, the free cash flow that you are generating is the only thing that drives your valuation. How long it will take to get to that point and how long you can raise money on metrics other than your fundamentals will vary, and how you might wish to exploit that to, you know, prevent dilution that can then be used to issue options to new employees. There are lots of great reasons to raise at increasingly high valuations, even in the absence of free cash flow generation. But I don't know how to answer your question other than to say that over a long enough time horizon, if you're not generating free cash flow, nothing else really matters.
Well, I think that in some instances, this can be situation specific, Pierre. And, you know, look at some examples in our space. And we don't know the numbers because these aren't necessarily publicly available today. Maybe they will be. But I mean, Lloyd, just look at the Entain acquisition of Angstrom as an example. We don't know what Angstrom's revenues were. They're a private company. But, you know, the rumor mill is that the price tag that was paid far exceeds what the appropriate revenue number multiple would be, whether you base it on revenue or you base it on EBITDA. If that's the case, why would Entain, and you know, in effect, it probably looks like a pretty good outcome for the VC firms that invested in Angstrom, as well as for the LPs and everyone involved in that situation. So, you know, maybe when Angstrom was rolling along, you know, the end result superseded what those revenues might have dictated during the process. And what really matters, Lloyd, you would agree, at the end is that end result. So sometimes it is situation specific. And I think how that can be justified in this particular instance, or in many instances, is the value for the acquiring company. And in the case of Entain, it isn't just based on what the third-party revenues are of a B2B company, but of what it could mean for Entain and their portfolio of companies internally and moving the needle for them as a pricing, bringing in some expertise on the pricing side. So I think that sometimes these situations, these circumstances can be situation specific.
All right, so for the fourth and final segment of today, we are doing our traditional deep dive. And today it is a really interesting such edition of the deep dive with Chris Bevilacqua of SimpleBet. You're the co-founder and the CEO of the company, Chris. It's great to have you here on the Vested Interest today. How are you doing?
I'm thrilled to be here for the deep dive. Let's get after it.
let's go deep today. I love it. So Chris, obviously you're the co-founder and CEO of SimpleBet, which is kind of the incumbent when it comes to micro betting in the North American landscape. But instead of me kind of butchering the introduction of your company, why don't we get the introduction from the man himself first?
So we're coming upon about two more weeks, we'll be hitting our 6-year anniversary. It's amazing. So we started 6 years ago and we've built, SimpleBet is a technology company at its core. And we have built technology that enables real time, as you said, micro betting and wagering on live sporting events in real time. And it, you know, micro betting is sort of the term that we use, but it's really wagering in micro time frames. So we offer, our technology enables, we're an enterprise software, right? So we sell our software to consumer facing businesses like the sports books like FanDuel and DraftKings and Caesars and Bet365 and others. And then we also do similarly in the world of media. So we have relationships where we're selling our technology to media companies who offer it more in like a fan engagement and free to play. So those are the two use cases, the technology, but it enables, essentially takes every pitch and every at bat in a baseball game, or every shot and every possession in a basketball game, or every play and every drive in an NFL game, and it creates a market and a betting opportunity that enables sportsbooks to offer a much more engaging in real-time engagement end user experience.
So, Chris, first of all, thanks for joining us. And, you know, I recall some of those early days, and I recall it vividly because the day that they announced the sale of my company, Don Best, is the day that I met initially Joey from Simple Bet and eventually met yourself. But in those early days, it was a challenge. It was a challenge in terms of finding some product market fit. And there was a lot of skepticism among the sports books. And, you know, for you, you know, getting at it in those early days, you know, what was the thought process when you were facing a lot of skepticism from the industry as a whole in regards to what you were bringing to market? Were there times early on in the journey when you questioned where the market fit was, or was there always a strong belief that you were going to get to where you are today as you continue to move the ball downfield?
You know, it's a great question. I mean, it's been, as you said, quite a journey, and the first couple of years were very hard, mostly because, candidly, I didn't know what the hell I was doing, right? I mean, you mentioned Joey Levy, my co-founder, and Scott Marshall, the other co-founder. And when we first started, we started the company a month before PASPA got repealed. So, like I always say, I was better to be lucky than smart. We were kind of in the right place at the right time, but we didn't really know what the heck we were going to build, right? So, you know, Joey and Scott had visions of what I would describe more broadly as just like a direct-to-consumer product, right, that was much more easy and much more intuitive for a user to bet with versus what at the time seemed to be like really complicated, lots of friction, getting new customers. And we just thought that there was some way to simplify the betting experience in the very, very early days. And we didn't really know whether we wanted to be a B2C company or a B2B company. And we got about a year or a year and a half into it, and we realized like we were trying to do both. And you know, me as the novice, we're like, well, wait a second, like we can't be the jack of all trades and the master of none. Like, we gotta like pick a lane. And you know, I did not want to fight the customer acquisition, I didn't want to be in that business. And and that's when we decided to like make the company a hard pivot into a B2B company focused on what we thought was the uniqueness of the North American market and the U.S. market, which was in the early stages. And that just really had to do with the nature of the sports and the cadence of football, baseball, and basketball here in the U.S. versus sports that like soccer and cricket and, you know, other sports that were more global that sports betting had been built off of. So we thought we had like there was like a white space. If we could build the technology that enabled that as the B2B supplier to that, even though, like you said a minute ago, there was a lot of skepticism from our customers, right? The DraftKings and the FanDuels of the world saying, well, you know, micro betting is going to always be like a niche product. But here we are 6 years later, and you know, it's a multi-billion dollar product today, and it probably is going to double over the next year or two. And it's like it's a real meaningful TAM behind the opportunity, and we're like by far the leaders in this space. But it was rocky beginning.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, but it was a rocky beginning. Sorry, Lloyd.
Well, no, I was going to add to that, because even once you decided, let's say, to focus more on B2B, I mean, I remember no one knew what micro betting was. The only time anyone said micro betting was when it was Europeans who thought they had enough experience to guarantee that no one ever wanted to do micro betting. There was not a single investor in 2018 sitting there saying, I hope a micro betting company comes to me for investment. And yet now, only 6 years later, I mean, Pierre referred to you as the incumbent, which is true. But people talk about SimpleBet as if you were always the incumbent. And not so long ago, nearly the entire industry doubted that people even wanted micro betting. And so it's, first of all, amazing to see the progress. The question I have selfishly is, what else are you guys working on now? You know, what does the next phase look like? What things that might not have a buzzword attached to them are getting your engineers excited? What does the future look like for SimpleBet? How does it become a $10 billion company from here?
Yeah, so one of the new exciting developments that we're working on in real time right now, which you're going to start to hear about, is, you know, we now have an SGP product. Like, if you just think about the whole ecosystem and where all of the action is, right, around 50% of all the GGR in the entire industry is coming out of SGPs, right, with essentially two customers, right, FanDuel and DraftKings. And, you know, what no one's ever been able to do is incorporate micros into the more traditional SGP product. And we now have built that. And so we're now actually going to be rolling that out during baseball season. And it'll be the first of its kind. We still don't have it live on a customer yet, but, you know, that's what we're working on right now. And, you know, that's sort of like where iGaming meets sports betting, right? Like the long odds of a lottery product, right, where you create these kind of correlated, you know, bets that cut across multiple categories. And the hardest thing to price in all that is micros, right? And no one's been able to do that at scale like we have. And so we're super excited about that. I mean, I think we're going to see a lot more. In addition, you're going to see on our side more of this single screen user experience, right? We've got a couple of deals now, one with LIV Golf as an example, where we're getting a low latency video stream paired with our micro betting markets underneath it, all in a single screen experience. We have that with IFL, the Indoor Football League, and we're working on, you know, you see what the NFL has done with their Bet Vision with Genius. They put their low latency video into sportsbook apps. Like Caesars right now did it last year, where they had the low latency video and they had Firebets. That's all our technology powering Firebets. So I think you're going to start to see, you know, our two biggest areas that we're looking to expand in are the SGPs and then all the single screen UX, you know, low latency video. Like our technology is tailor-made for that experience.
I have a question just to follow up on the comment that Lloyd made on the Europeans that were kind of quick to dismiss the microgaming product. And that's actually a sentiment that I still hear to this day. It seems to be Europeans that are somewhat dismissive of the microbetting product. So I just want to ask you, Chris, how do you think about expansion outside of the North American market? And what do you want to say to the Europeans that are dismissing this product?
Listen, it makes sense that that's what they would say, because the dominant sports betting product, you know, for decades has been soccer. And, you know, soccer just it has a different cadence to it. It's a continuous flow sport. It has very little scoring. It's really hard to build a micro product around soccer, right? If anyone's going to crack that code, I think it's going to be us. But so it makes sense that the European audience would say that micro betting wouldn't work. What they missed on, and why, you know, the last 6 years has been somewhat frustrating to me, because what ended up happening was you had all of the European know-how come over to the US and start sports betting. And here we are 5 years into it, and everybody sells the same product. It's like, no wonder it costs $900 to get a new customer. It's like, you guys brought all your old tech over. You brought all your old engineers over. Like, you built the same product for U.S. sports, and it's not soccer, right? So that's what we saw 6 years ago. Like, if we could build something different, by the time those guys realize it, they're going to be years behind, which is what's happened.
Hey, Chris, question for you here. You know, you talk about it being almost a six-year anniversary. I recall your early days, and as you allude to, you came from outside the space and obviously an accomplished business person. But back in those early days, you were learning about the space, and here you are now somewhat of 5-6 years later, dare I say almost a veteran in our space, if I will. But what has surprised you the most about the industry, you know, now that you're a few years in and have some seasons under your belt? Whether it's the good, the bad, the ugly, what are some of the things that surprised you being a part of this industry thus far in your tenure?
There's a handful of things that have surprised me. The first being, like I just said a minute ago, like we had for many years, you had engineers running these companies, right? And, you know, these are like sales and marketing companies that are using old tech to try to like build. And so here we are 6 years into it, and there's now roughly 10 million MAUs, right? Yet there's about 100 million or so people, depending on what study you look at, who bet on sports in the United States, whether that's a March Madness pool or a Super Bowl box. So you have this huge audience, right, that hasn't come into the ecosystem, into the regulated system anyway, because it's too freaking complicated. It's like the user experience, it's just awful. So surprise number one was I thought, you know, that would have been recognized much faster than it has been, right? Credit to FanDuel and DraftKings to crack the SGP code. That's where a lot of the upside, you know, why they have 80% market share. But, you know, everybody else catching up, and, you know, it's kind of the same rinse repeat formula, how to get new customers. And so I think that's been a surprise. The second one, and I say this with respect because I come out of the media industry and I've been working at sports leagues and in sports my whole life. And it's surprising to me how the leagues have architected the data trap. I'll call it the data trap. And what I mean by that is that, you know, they've architected, you know, how they collect data during their live event, right? And they basically hire a reseller like Genius or Radar, who then gets to pick and choose who all the winners of innovation products are by virtue of the fact they monopolize the data. And I think, you know, and I've had this discussion with the commissioners at the leagues, and I've said, you know, like, even if you get $100 million a year for data rights, which is a lot of money, but, you know, it's $3 million a club, yet you're trying to sell your media rights for $10 billion. And the way you get more value and more compensation for your media rights is you have people watching your broadcasts and your telecasts longer. In other words, they're more engaged. So things like fan engagement and things like sports betting is like, you know, it's the mother of all fan engagement tools. And so there's $100 million here and there's $10 billion over here, and you're handcuffing yourself on maximizing where all of the industry revenue is. And so that was a surprise, like that there wasn't more thoughtful thinking around how all this should be architected in the first place. And, you know, I would say, and this last one won't surprise you guys now that we're 6 years into it, but, like, you know, like, I got into this, I'm like, I didn't know what I didn't know, right? You know, I just didn't come out of the sports betting industry, and I didn't realize, like, you know, how long, I mean, I got into this, and, you know, I'm an investor, I'm an entrepreneur, everything, you know, like, it's 5 to 10 years. All right, well, we're 60% of the way of that journey, and it's been a rough 6 years. But you get into this business and you realize that, like, how much scale matters, whether you're on the B2B side or whether you're on the B2C side. And I never would have envisioned, like, we'd get all the way into this and, like, we're just like a pimple on a fly's ass. Like even though we're pushing through multi-billion dollars worth of volume on our markets alone, it's like the rest of the ecosystem, it's like they somehow look at it and they say, well, we can do that. We don't need Simplebet to do that. We'll do that. Right. So as a third party supplier that's offering, like, you then are in, like, wait a minute, now I'm competing against my customers. Like, I'm telling you, we just took 6 years to do all this, and it's really, really hard to do. And you got 1,000 other things you're doing. So that surprised me that, you know, that's sort of the way this has evolved.
Well, it's certainly a large pimple, Chris. I'll give you that. I want to
end on a boil by now. Right.
I want to end on a separate note here. So, you know, you built a fantastic company. You talked about kind of the economies of scale and the importance of that. And you somewhat have looked down the North American industry with offering your product already to most major operators. But how do you think about your competition? So there is a couple of organizations that are trying to offer similar products. Like Kira Sports comes to mind, Nvenue, for example. Considering that you have already locked down most of the North American market, how do you think about your competition and these organizations?
Yeah, like I've told our team, like, let's not worry about the competition. We're certainly way ahead, right? You just mentioned two, like Nvenue and Kiro. And I think Kiro's got a little bit of distribution over in the international markets. But in the North American markets, like, it's getting harder and harder to get integrations from outside third parties. I mean, Nvenue has done quite a bit that I'll say in kind of the media side of the world, but like, it's hard to get paid for that stuff, right? Like, and I don't believe, I could be wrong, but I don't believe as of this recording that Nvenue's technology is live in real money betting anywhere. So, you know, like, we hear about them all the time, but I say to our folks, like, don't worry about what anybody else is doing. Like, we're the leaders. We've got, you know, we've got pretty much everyone except two big customers, FanDuel and MGM. Like, pretty much everybody else is using our tech. And so I think it's going to be hard for Nvenue and Kiro, for example, to, you know, get in front of us, at least here in the North American markets. So I, you know, like, I can't control what they're doing. I actually like Kelly, right? I like Tomash. They're good people. I just figure, as the leader in the category, if all boats rise, that's a good thing.
Absolutely true. Well, thank you so much, Chris, for taking your time today. It was great to see you last week as well in New York, and I wish you certainly all the best of luck from my side.
All right. Well, thanks for having me on today, guys.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Chris.
All right. See you.